Well, we are continuing on our study of the 1689 Confession. We've made it to chapter 9, and we've made it to the final two paragraphs of chapter 9. Chapter 9 speaks of free will. And we've talked about free will in the sense that God has not made us robots, nor has he programmed us as computers. Nor are we puppets with strings attached to us. And all of that would have been wonderful, more than we could have understood, greater than any of us could have ever comprehended, that God would have programmed us to do his will, or that he would have some organic or metaphysical string on our minds, our mouths, our hearts, that he would move us whithersoever he wills, even as he moves the rivers of water. And yet it's much greater than that. We do have freedom. We know we have freedom. We feel this freedom. We feel the freedom of choice. You sense that. When you make a choice, you don't feel, you know, unless someone, I mean, you might feel the pressure of someone looking over your shoulder, or You're trying to please someone, or not to be caught by someone. So you might change your attitude and make a choice that would be contrary to what you really desired to do. But often none of that happens to us. And if it did, then we have chosen to be influenced by them. So it's still a freedom. Still a choice. We never feel violence. We never feel our will being twisted by any power of God. We simply make our choices, knowing that man in his fallen condition loves sin and cannot do those things or will those things that will accompany salvation, that indeed we're wholly locked into a nature that is contrary to God and contrary to the will of God. And indeed we will never know God, never come to God because we don't desire to. The depravity of man, and we've talked about the sinfulness of man, but the depravity of man is a willful depravity. I know these things might not be able to be understood fully by you or fully by us or by any man, even the people that know the most and have the highest IQ and the highest reasoning or the most powerful reasoning abilities. These things are still beyond them. I have not seen, ear hath not heard, nor entered into the heart of man the things God has prepared for them that love him. It's revealed by the Spirit. No one will see this by empirical investigation. No one will be taught this by the most powerful and persuasive of teacher. And no one will ever contemplate these things and come to an understanding of them. God must reveal it. But when God does reveal it, Paragraph 4 says, when God converts a sinner, that's very interesting, the word convert means to transform him completely. And again, the next word, and translates him into the state of grace. I've had on my mind for many years to edit a book about the conversion experiences of people. And I was going to call... My working title of that book was Translations. We were translated. That is, we were taken from one place and put into another. We were transformed. When God converts a sinner, and it is the work of God, and the sinner is converted, he's not trying to be converted, he's not trying to do what he has to do in order to know God, he is moved upon by the power of God. He's born of the Spirit, so he's converted. He's not what he was. She's not what she was. And now she is translated. He is translated into the state of grace. Now we live in grace. And when this grace comes to us by the power of the Spirit, we are freed from the natural bondage under sin. Sin now does not have to reign over us. And in fact, we're commanded not to allow it to reign over us. We're commanded to think the thoughts of God. We're commanded to give ourselves fully to Him, both in soul and in heart and in mind and in might. And we desire to do that. It's not contrary. It's not contrary to us. We desire to do it. We want to do it. It's not something that God is making us do. It is something God is allowing us to do and enabling us to do. And this is by grace alone. By grace alone, He enables him freely. Freely. He's not forcing him. He's not programming him. He's not making him. There's no violence done to him. But he freely enables him freely to will and to do that which is spiritually good. Yet, because we have remaining corruption in us, I think it was Robertson, who wrote, "Prone to wander," like to wander around. Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. So what do? Well, his conclusion was, so here's my heart. Take it and seal it for your courts above. And I contend, and I've said this, I think this came to me either one day in prayer or one day in preaching, but it came to me that once a man comes to Christ, he never stops coming to him. That's why we persevere. That's why we are preserved, because this coming to Christ is in the present tense. It is continually coming to Christ. And the correlation to that is that when Christ saves a man, he never stops saving that man. When Christ saves one, he never stops saving that one. It's not just a moment act and then forgetting you. No, he invades with his power that is not only absolute omnipotent power, but it's continuous omnipresent power. Dealing with these corruptions. So these corruptions are there and it's a war. And because of this, we don't perfectly nor only will that which is good. Because in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good things. No good things. And if we never forget that, then we will not be subject to falling. If we forget that, then we shall fall immediately. And I talked to you last week about that, about the idea that we would do those things that we don't want to do and the things that we want to do. We don't do. If you've been a Christian for any length of time, you know about this war in you. But one day, we will win fully and completely. This will, paragraph 5 says, of man is made perfectly and immutably, that means unchangeably, free. To good alone in the state of glory only. So this thing says two things to us. This paragraph says two things to us. The first thing it says is that indeed one day sin will no longer be a problem for us. But it also says that that day will not be here. So it speaks against, I mean, positively, it doesn't denounce it, but positively, if we understand this, it speaks against sinless perfection. And there are those people that actually believe that they are sinlessly perfect. Now, of course, the only way they could ever believe that is one of two things, if not both, that they have a low view of sin and a high view of their performance. But I can tell you this, the closer you get to God, the more you know you don't by nature belong there. What happened when men saw the glory of God? Just run it right through the Bible. What happened? When the angel of the Lord that reflected the glory of God appeared to Mary, what did he have to say to her first? Fear not. And in the other places, the angels of the Lord came at the birth of Christ. Fear not. When Isaiah saw the Lord high and lifted up, what did he say? Woe! It's me. I am undone. I dwell amidst a people of unclean lips. His lips are unclean, and their lips are unclean. Now it's interesting that this is the prophet saying. You see, why would it may be funny to you in the sixth chapter of Isaiah that he's talking about his lips? And that the angel takes a coal off the altar and runs down and puts it on his lip. Why? Because he's the prophet. Who is faithful, as the Apostle Paul says, for such things? How can we speak these words when we know what we are in the very depth of our being? Are we mouthing these things just without feeling them? Are we saying these things knowing that we cannot live these things? Yes, our lips are unclean. Every preacher should say that. The apostle says, who's sufficient for these things? When I speak, it's a sweet-smelling savor of life to life and death to death. Who's sufficient for this? I mean, what preacher could really stand up and believe he is what he should be? When he's saying what he should say. Someone walked out of the back of the church. In fact, one time my mother-in-law came to hear me preach and she walked out of the back of the church and she says, you stepped on my toes. That's not very good when your mother-in-law is saying things like that to you. You know, you stepped on my toes. And I said, yes, ma'am. And I stepped on my own toes. You really know that you're preaching what God would have you preach, or at least you're getting it from some other source than yourself, when you are preaching along and convict yourself with your preaching. Usually hypocrites stay away from those kind of subjects. But why did he touch his lips? I'm not worthy to speak this truth. But he touched his lips with a coal from the altar and cleansed him. It's the power of God, you see. And then God asked in the air, you know, who shall we send? And who will go for us? And immediately Isaiah, just a few minutes ago, a man of unclean lips now saying, I will, here am I, send me. And then, of course, you know the rest of the story. He says, well, you go and you preach, but hearing, they won't hear, and seeing, they won't see. Lest they turn and confess their sin, lest they turn and be converted, and I should heal them. You're going, Isaiah, but you won't be successful. He didn't say, well, I'm not going. He just said, well, how long do you want me to go? How long should I keep doing this? Until everything's destroyed. Well, we know that there is sin in this life. And no matter how much we give ourselves to the things of God, I can tell you this. The Apostle Paul said he had a thorn in the flesh. What was it? Well, they contemplate. I don't know. It might have been something so... If he told us, it might be something that was so mundane to us, so far from our understanding of these things, that we would be astounded by, why are you so concerned about something so simple? I remember when Paul and I got married on September the 4th, and we got married over Labor Day, so I'd have a day, an extra day, so we could go somewhere on a honeymoon. And we didn't eat any honey, and I don't think I ever saw the moon, but that's what they called it. And so I went back to school, and I had this brand new wedding ring, this beautiful, shiny. In fact, I was so thin back then that it would slip off my finger. Now I'm so fat, I can't even wear it. But it slipped off my finger one time. I thought I lost it, but I found it, thank the Lord. But I'm sitting in this class, so I'm married, so it's the same semester which I got married in 76. I graduated in July of 77. I'm sorry, in January of 77. And no, that's not right. Never mind. I think I graduated in December of 77, but this was the semester. So I stayed a semester and a year, so three semesters before I graduated, married. Now, so this ring was brand new, shiny. Well, I was sitting in this plant pathology class, and we had a dissection or dissecting microscope, so you could look in there, and it would make the plant look almost gigantic, so you could cut little sections out of it, so you could look into it to see what disease. And so I remember the final exam that there were microscopes throughout the room. I think they were set up like something like 75 microscopes, and we had to go through and look in the microscope and write down the disease just by what. So we had to memorize all this stuff. Well, one day in class, I was sitting there and we're waiting for the teacher to come, and I'm sitting in front of this dissecting microscope. And so I decided I would put my ring, the shiny new, brand new ring, under the dissecting microscope, and I put it under there, and I was shocked how scratched and pitted and unsmooth it was. Now, you know why you can see things more clearly in a microscope or a telescope is because it concentrates the light. See, our seeing is about light, so it concentrates this light. And I've often used this as an illustration. The closer you get to the light, the more you can see your corruptions. And we want to be close to the Lord. But as you get closer to the Lord, your corruptions are more and more and more manifest. But one day, when we are closer to the light than we have ever been, we shall see perfection that is unchangeable. And we will be as Christ, for we shall see him as he is. So in Ephesians chapter 4, he gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers. And this is for the edification of the saints, till we all come in the unity of the faith. Verse 13, so this is Ephesians 4:13. Till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God. So we come to the full knowledge and we all come there together, unity, unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. So, three words that explain what has happened to us. If I put the fourth word in there, then that would bring us back to eternity, election, then justification. That's when God declares us as righteous. And justification saves us from the penalty of sin. Sanctification saves us, and in the word, you hear the word holy in there, sanctus. I mean, if we use the word holy, it'd be holification, becoming holy. God saves us in sanctification from the power of sin. But one day, glorification, you hear the word glory in that, we shall be saved from the presence of sin. And oh, what a day, glorious day, that will be. When my Jesus, I shall see, when I look upon his face, the one who redeemed me by his grace, we shall see him as he is, and we shall be like him. And yet we shall grow in that knowledge. It's like a river glorious. The line, and like the river glorious, captures this thought. Perfect, yet it floweth fuller every day. Perfect, yet it groweth deeper all the way. Stayed upon Jehovah, hearts are fully blessed, finding as he promised, perfect peace and rest. We see everything with jaundiced eyes. The first day of heaven, the first moment. And I don't know why we fight and hold on so fiercely to this life, because it's all we know, I guess. But the first moment of heaven, we shall see him without the cataract of sin, clearly. Unlike we ever have. And then it only gets better. I'm telling you, the first day in heaven will be the worst day in heaven, because it only gets better. Perfect. And we're not, and it's not just glorious in the sense that it's something we've experienced that we've never experienced. It's much beyond that, because there's only one desire that we have now, and that desire will be enhanced fully and absolutely in heaven. The only desire that we will have in heaven is a desire to know Him, to see Him, to love Him, and to serve Him. Nothing else. No divided heart, no duplicitous mind. Him. And we will be able to. And that will be the joy of that experience.